All right, let me pause there for a moment and welcome our guest and give him a proper introduction here because his work has been so long, extensive, and important. Kambale Musavuli is a native of the Democratic Republic of Congo. He's a human rights activist. He's the student coordinator and national spokesperson with the Friends of the Congo organization. He has written for the Washington Post, Foreign Policy and Focus, the Huffington Post, and numerous other academic and news publications. And he's been interviewed by a whole panoply of media that I won't take the time to fully lay out. But I do want to let it be known that Mr. Musavuli was profiled by the United States Holocaust Memorial Museum in Community in Action, a campaign to bring public awareness to individuals who have chosen to take action to confront genocide and related crimes against humanity. In 2009, he received the Congolese Hero Award by the Congolese Development Center National Awards Program. Mr. Musavuli continues to tour the United States, Canada, and Africa, speaking to university students, religious groups, global leaders, community organizers, and many others in an effort to generate support for the people of the Congo. And he's here to talk with us a little bit today about Congo Week, Patrice Lumumba, and the relationship that Pan-Africanism plays to his work and to that of his colleagues and comrades. So Brother Kambale, thank you very much for joining us and welcome. So first, let me just say thank you and welcome.
Thank you, and very humbling. You know, I'm always scratching my head. I say, I don't know what's in that bio, you know.
Well, I just went to the Friends of the Congo website and grabbed some of the paragraphs from there. But so I hope that did you justice.
No, I mean, it's very humbling because, I mean, the way I like to even be remembered, like, especially for this context, right, is I went to ANT. It's an HBCU. And everything that I represent and everything that I've become today, if I didn't go to Greensboro, I wouldn't be doing this. If I didn't go to ANT, you wouldn't know even what I'm doing. And just to give you even a background, I came in the United States. I came to the United States, that was 1998, as a refugee. That was when the second war in the Congo started. And I grew up in Greensboro. I was very active with the community then. And, you know, you get this moment where, you know, you are an immigrant and, you know, you came to the U.S. So you want the American dream, which is this nice house, nice driveway with a car. Your parents say, go study, you know, science. You know, I study civil engineering at ANT and others, right? But there was a contradiction where I lived. The biggest contradiction, and I always remind my mother this. My mother lived in the neighborhood where the Greensboro massacre happened. She got a grant from the U.S. government as a first-time home buyer. The house is built. People are buying plots. She has no idea that the Greensboro massacre actually took place where she bought her house. The only reason why I know is as a student at ANT, I was a member of the Black History Club. And also, we did a lot of work with the Beloved Community Center. We Reverend Nelson Johnson. And we did a lot of events, you know, like we'll go to the city hall and put pressure on the, you know, the mayor and everything, because they always did us wrong at ANT. Like they were trying to build a dumping ground across ANT campus. And this was being passed at city hall. And we had to go there to say, no, you don't put a dumping ground across the university. Go put it at UNCG if you want. That's the white school, right? So they educated me because he himself is a survivor of the Greensboro massacre. So I don't know if any of you know even the story.
I was
going
to ask if our students, we haven't talked about that in this class. Do any of you know what he's talking about, the Greensboro massacre?
No.
So,
okay, this is
in
important.
The 70s, right? And I'll say what I know, not the book, because I was with Reverend Nelson Johnson. We were doing, you know, the whole work around truth and reconciliation there. The black community and communists at the time organized against the KKK. And why? Because the KKK was going to do a rally in the city of Greensboro. You see how arrogant they are right now with Black Lives Matter? They are so arrogant and Trump has like, that's how he was in the 70s. So it's like what happened back then is happening now. So people said, this is crazy. How can the Klan just do this rally in the city of Greensboro? So the community organized a rally called Death to the Klan. They had the permits. The city knew this was going to happen. So the police was informed. The press was informed. So the community came, right? So you had some communists there. You had African-American community there ready to, you know, organize and all. As they were ready to organize, that day, the police decided not to come to where the protest was. The press showed up, right? Then later, while they were still in the community ready to do the rally, the KKK members in their vehicles drove into the neighborhood where my mom lives today. And people were singing, death to the Klan, death to the Klan. The reason I know this also is because the video is online. You can go on YouTube and type Greensboro Massacre. You see it. And the video is from the press. So the press showed up. So they're protesting against the KKK. So they drive by the people. They come out of the vehicle. They pull up their guns. And they shoot at people. And three people died that day. Like filmed, right? The intention was there. And yet, no one was found guilty. They went to trial. Filmed by the press, they went to trial. So Reverend Nelson Johnson, that entire time, has been fighting for justice. To just even have just some truth and reconciliation. Nobody's going to go to jail. Let's just get information that not the city is taking responsibility for it. Now they have, in some shape or form, but it's not fully yet, not still ongoing. So that's how I know. And because we came to the community sometime for memorial. But imagine decades later where this crime took place. They gentrified the community. I mean, they wiped out the community. Brought a new community. And people who may have a little money, sometimes immigrants, we get opportunities that even African-Americans don't get. So I understand that privilege. And my mom got a grant. Say, hey, your credit is good. Here's a grant. $20,000 you don't have to reimburse. Here are the plots. Buy it. And the tree where they actually killed them, there was a memorial tree that was there for the people. The city cut the tree. And I can guarantee you, if you go to the community, you ask anybody who live in this new development, they have no idea. Mm. So that's why I said that I'm humbled that I went to ANT. Things that I did not know about the situation of blacks in the United States. It's not taught to us in Africa. We know there was slavery, but the way it reads is probably how it reads in many schools in the United States, right? It reads as, you know, there were black people taken. They were working in a plantation against their will. Every now and then, you know, there were some who ran away. When they ran away, they called them and brought back to the plantation. And when they said, no, they're working too much. Let's make sure that they can have a better life. They got a better life. But I said, you couldn't vote. That there was this guy who brought people together, you know, said, no. I have a dream, black boy and black girls can, you know, work together. They said, well, we want black boys and black girls to come together. They gave them the right to vote. And then the blacks just blew up. They had the Michael Jordans, they had the Michael Jackson. You know, everybody wants to come. And even in my context, right, 1996, there is a war that starts. So my family has to flee. Where do we go, right, for safety? And then that's how I ended up in Greensboro. So that's why I was saying, and it's a long introduction, but the reason why I say I'm humbled, even the history of Congo Week started at North Carolina A&T State University. So no one can tell. I make sure everywhere I go, I remind people that. It was in the black university in Greensboro, North Carolina, talking to my classmates about the Congo. They could not believe what's happening there. I said, wow, is this what's happening? We'll help you, Kambale. They helped organize Congo Week on campus, which has become a global movement over 600 universities and 60 countries around the world do Congo Week. So I don't want one day to wake up and hear Duke University started it. No, ANC State University started Congo Week, you know?
Well, there's a lot that, first of all, I appreciate that story. There's a lot to and it's perfect because we started today's class talking about an article we read about Fela Kuti and his experience coming here from Nigeria and building and having that experience and influence and with Black people here help build, you know, his Afrobeat sound in politics. So that's perfect that you said. So I want to let me just say that so far what we've been talking about today, we went over a little bit of the basic, the very overview history, the Berlin Conference, the development of the great African cake, so to speak, how Belgium took hold of what became the Congo, and then a quick summary up until Patrice Lumumba comes to power and is assassinated. And I've mentioned just briefly that Patrice Lumumba was part of a Pan-African triumvirate of heroes born in 1925 with Frantz Fanon in Martinique and Malcolm X in the United States, and all considered part of a Pan-African, you know, movement, and all, you know, well, depending on how you read the end of Fanon, all assassinated or dealt with harshly by Western powers. And then we haven't really talked. I've given a little bit about the role the Congo plays in terms of natural resources and coltan, and but we don't know enough certainly about any of that history. Number one, but certainly about the current state of the Congo. And then I definitely want to have our students open up with their questions and comments about anything, including, as some have pointed out, that they wanted to hear specifically more from today's continental Africans talking about the idea of Pan-Africanism. And we've had members of the diaspora, but not live and in person. Somebody, you are first guest directly from the continent, so to speak, so that they can talk with you about that as well. So yeah, please, if you were, just give us respond to any of that that you think we might need to know about the history, but then also talk a little bit about what's going on in the country today and its role in supporting global capitalism, for lack of a better phrase.
Yeah. I mean, the challenge of the Congo historically is for the Congolese people to determine their affairs, and the fact that you already went back to the Berlin Conference, and I hope you're all clear that it wasn't called the Berlin Conference. When you look at the archives, that meeting was actually called Congo Conferences in German, the Congo Conference. So while they talk about, we went to the Berlin Conference to cover up Africa, their meeting was called Congo Conference. And now we have access to the document. I mean, you can pull it up on Google, the Act of Berlin, right? When you read the Act of Berlin, it clearly states that a nation called the United States was a signatory. I don't think people really realize, well, when they carved up the African continent, two folks, John Stanton, if I'm not mistaken, and Harry Sanford. And Harry Sanford is somebody all of you should know, because the city of Sanford, Florida, is named after him, where they killed Trayvon Martin. Ooh. He was a diplomat, right, who made money for representing the U.S. at the Berlin Conference, and he actually signed on behalf of the U.S., ratifying the carving up of Africa, and the division of Africa was to also give Congo, not to a country, but to one man running it as a corporation, and they called it Congo Free State, not because it was free, but because it was free for all. It was a free trade zone. Any European nation could take whatever they wanted in the Congo. Right, and this was signed on February 26, 1885. So what may have happened on February 26, 2012? Anybody knows? In Central Florida, what happened on February 26, 2012?
Sorry.
That is the day they killed Trayvon Martin. Trayvon Martin was killed in the city named after the guy who signed on behalf of the United States. He signed on behalf of the United States, made money, bought land in Florida, put indentured servants from, I think, Ireland and other places, displaced the native from their land, And because he was this rich man who bought the land, they named the city after him. And Trayvon Martin was killed on the day of the signing of the Act of Berlin in that city that still had the history of that. But that brings us back up now to, let me just move to Lumumba now. Even what Lumumba represents. And this is to share, you know, a story from, I don't know if you know Dr. Yvonne Sian, that's Dave Chappelle's mother. She's helped us a lot in our work. I met her initially in 2009 at her friends in the Congo, but she's been very active. Dr. Yvonne Sian was actually in the Congo. She also met Lumumba in 1960. She met him in D.C. She went to, if I'm not mistaken, she did go to Howard. She had a minor in French. So she spoke French. She met with him. Lumumba asked her to come to the Congo, and she went. So I asked her just a general question. I said, Dr. Sian, you were young. She said, yeah, I was in my early 20s. I said, in your early 20s, why did you just decide to leave the U.S. and go there? I said, come back, you need to know what was happening back then. To see a black man as a prime minister in his own country where we were treated like second, third-class citizen, that was inspiring for all of us. So that was the context. Things were moving there. They were motivating us as they were fighting for independence. And it was, we also here in the United States, we were fighting for civil rights and others. And that era, that was the case, right? 58, 59, and 60, you have Kwame Nkrumah coming as, you know, the head of state of Ghana to the, to the United Nations. You have people like Elombe Braff, who kept the story of Africans over in Harlem, mobilizing people. Many folks will not know that you have Amiri Baraka, Maya Angelou, and Max Roach, and a few others who mobilized on February 15, 1961, a protest where, not in front of the United Nations, not in some room, they were able to get inside of the United Nations Security Council on that day, protesting the death of Patrice Lumumba, killed by the CIA, and calling the U.S. ambassador on the U.N. floor murderer. That day, Amiri Baraka was arrested, and if you have read things he wrote, his speeches, he has always said the first time he got arrested in the United States was a protest that he did to denounce the U.S. killing of Patrice Lumumba. So that movement of independence, the killing of Patrice Lumumba, is very significant for the Congo. Africans came together, not just Congolese, and that goes to even the definition of Pan-Africanism. I'm calling you right now from Accra, Ghana. I'm not from Ghana, but I'm here with the Ghanaians. They're able to embrace me. They have that within them, right? the way of life in Ghana, right? Because of the intensive work that took place with Kwame Nkrumah. But during that period, many Africans went to other African countries to organize and mobilize to help others become independent. That's what happened in the Congo in 1958. Now I'm throwing dates. I hope you're nodding and you're going to check back, right? In 1958, the All African People's Conference took place in Ghana. You had Frantz Fanon that attended. You had Patrice Lumumba that attended. You had Nyerere, like all these young Africans who were fighting. It's like, let's just put it 2020. What would that look like? Young African-Americans who are leading the Black Lives Matter movement attending the All African People's Conference of today. Why am I saying that? Back then, you had Du Bois, you had Padmore, you had Fanon, right? Those were young Africans from around the globe, not just the continent, from the Caribbean, from the U.S. Whenever you study Du Bois, do they tell you that he actually worked for an African government? What they talk to you is Renaissance. Renaissance, right? The Harlem Renaissance. That's what they actually just teach you. They don't tell you that this guy left the United States, went on the African continent, is buried in Ghana. He's buried in his house, him and his wife, right? You can go there and see it. There is the Du Bois Center. but he moved here, was an advisor to Kwame Nkrumah, an advisor to a head of state of another country, bringing his knowledge and experience, understanding like the system of oppression in the United States, and warning Africans to say, you may not know the beast. Our mothers have breastfed their children. Our people have been killed and massacred. You need to know who you're dealing with when you become independent. But these young people mobilized in 1958 for the All African People's Conference, and you had all these people. Patrice Lumumba came also. And when he came, something was shared with him that is really the essence of why we became independent. Kwame Nkrumah told him that the Congo River can provide electricity to the entire African continent. That if Congo's land and resources is in the hands of Africans, it's going to transform the entire African world. So he had the mission to go to the Congo, but he did not go alone. There were Chadians that went back to him with him in the Congo. There were Cameroonian, and there is a woman that you must know. Her name is André Blouin. She was born in Central African Republic. She did not see herself as a Central African woman. She worked in Congo Brazzaville. She worked with Kwame Nkrumah, and she also worked with Sékou Touré of Guinea. Because of her talent and skills, and because she spoke some of the Congolese languages, specifically Kikongo, in 1960, this woman was sent to the Congo, working with Patrice Lumumba in the Congo. That, just think about people just moving from countries to countries, helping movement. Like a Pan-African brigade, just going to help for independence. So she went there, and when Congo became independent in 1960, she's the one actually who wrote the Independence Day speech. So as you study and read Patrice Lumumba's words of June 30th, 1960, speaking to the Congolese, a woman wrote that speech.
Can you put her name in the chat? Because we actually did watch and then read from some of that just today, but I didn't know her name or this part. Thank you.
And very interesting, her daughter is living in New York too, right? Because you know, they had to flee the Congo in 1961 after the assassination of Lumumba. First, she was kicked out of the Congo. Yeah. More than likely, that is the CIA. She was very close to Lumumba, and she was one of the people who was sent to the Congo by Sékou Touré and Kwame Nkrumah. And she became the chief of protocol of Patrice Lumumba. So when he came to the U.S. in July 1960, he came there in August of 1960, she came with him. And she was almost like the advisor to Patrice Lumumba, making sure that he knows the ropes, what's going on, and so on. And because of her influence, many, many like Western agents didn't like her. They did everything in their power that she was out of the Congo before he was arrested, and then later killed, buried, unburied, chopped up into pieces, put his body in acid to make sure that his body never exists again. And like, put in sulfuric acid and just made it erase. And the only thing that was left of Lumumba was his tooth and a finger. Mm. Why do I know this? Because the two Belgian mercenaries, now both of them are dead, but one of them in the early 2000s did a documentary in Belgium. That documentary is also online. But this guy is talking to the reporter, said that there are Congolese who believe that Lumumba never died, that he may resurrect. But I tell you, if he does resurrect, he will have one tooth missing, and he starts laughing. And he goes into his pocket, takes out a pouch, takes a tooth out of the pouch, show it to the camera, and said, that's his tooth. He died. When, of course, that happened, there were massive protests in Belgium. Then he said, no, I don't have it, that threat in the water. After he died, his daughter said that she had it too. So it's almost they have this obsession with like prize, like
trophy. Like, I mean, well, that's a colonial pattern, pathology. People collect their trophies. They do it all the time. So exactly. That makes perfect sense. It's gross.
And yeah, go ahead. Sorry. And this year, his daughter on June 30th sent a letter to Belgium officially saying, you need to send my father's remains back. And officially in August, Belgium has agreed to send Lumumba's tooth back to the Congo. In 2020, that's when we're getting his remain back. But Patrice, I share Patrice Lumumba what he meant. I share how he was, his work on the ground was a Pan-African work where many even Africans participated in it. And the liberation of the Congo was so critical at the time because of the potential that he had. Kwame Nkrumah had a United States of Africa plan where he said that the capital of the United States of Africa will be Kinshasa. Like he understood, he said, this place, this land, if it's in the hands of Africa, will develop. And in current Congo today, and I would even say current Africa, I mean, I think we've been misinformed, miseducated on both sides, right? Not everyone understands Pan-Africanism, how it should be understood, because people actually think Pan-Africanism is about location. So if I have an office in Johannesburg, an office in Luanda, an office in Accra, I'm a Pan-African company. A company like that is called EcoBank. Imagine there is a company, a company that's all over Africa right now. They call themselves a Pan-African bank. And I always joke about it in Ghana. I say, there is nothing Pan-African about a bank that's extracting surplus value at extreme levels.
Just before you came on, we were talking about the concept that Europeans are the best Pan-Africanists because they're the ones that understand, so people looking with that capitalist worldview mindset, of course, they're going to look at Africa as all and exploit Africa all collectively, whereas the rest of us are encouraged into confusion against Pan-African ideas or use of Pan-Africanism for our own benefits. Go ahead.
Even with the example you just gave, right? Europe stole the European Union model from Africa.
That's right.
The African Union, the organization African Unity, was launched in 1963. There was no European Union there. And who are the founding fathers of that? Nasser.
That's right.
Kwame Nkrumah, right? They came together as saying, like even if you read his speech, his May 25th, 1963 speech, Kwame Nkrumah made a speech in Addis Ababa on at the anniversary of it, right? He says, to understand what his vision was, we need a Pan-African institution of states. We also need a people's Pan-Africanism, a Pan-African institution. And what I share is we're still missing the peoples. That's why the African Union is not working. Like Kwame Nkrumah knew it. So yes, you can have African governments in a union, but you still need to have a branch where the people themselves are organized. So the All African People's Conference that you saw in 1958, this wasn't a meeting of governments. This was a meeting of peoples. That's why they call it the All African People's Conference, right?
Right.
African peoples in struggle, outside of government officials, I said, the people, you come together and we continue to build on it. And his ideas, right, many of them have become concrete. Like, the African Union exists today because of Kwame Nkrumah's ideas, right? And it's trying to achieve a half to one-third vision of what he wanted to see as Pan-Africanism. And there are other elements in it. One currency. Who was fighting for one currency? Gaddafi. Where is Gaddafi today?
And who got rid of him? Talking about the opposite of Pan-Africanism. Who helped get rid of him? I mean, it was Obama.
So in 2008, I was in Greensboro too, right?
God.
So in my mobilization, I usually went to meetings that had African American in it, right? So I went to Unity. I don't know if you know Unity. It's a meeting of journalists of colors. It happens every 4 years.
Oh, yeah.
So in 2008, I went to the Unity conference, one of the most depressing moments of my life. I am meeting people who are looking at me, telling me, you know, this is election year. Black president is about to get in. This story of the Congo you're talking about, I don't think he's going to go. I actually met, because in to understand unity, right, one from the organizing perspective, unity conference is free. When you pay, then you get to go to special events for those who have paid, right? They have this special fancy dinner. But anybody can walk in it. So when I found out that there was a meeting with about 50,000 journalists of colors, man, I went with a friend. We had flyers who were distributing. I met Joy Reid. I met Roland Martin. I met Soledad O'Brien. Like, I can show you the pictures on my Facebook feed. Like, I met these people. I gave them information about the Congo. They did this thing like, yes, send me an email with a title such and such. You send an email, you never hear about anything. The only person I still remember that understood it, her name is Natalie Hopkinson, and she was the editor of theroots.com at the time.
Yeah, I know Natalie. Mm-hmm.
She's the only one who followed up. Out of the thousands of journalists that I met at Unity, she's the only one. But most of them was telling me that 2008 is not a good year to mobilize for the issues of the Congo because everybody's focused on the black president. And during that time, too, they were saying, give him 4 years, because after 4 years, he may have more room to do what he wanted. So 2012 comes, they say, wow, the Republicans control anything. I think you screw Kambale. So 8 years went on where you can hold this man accountable for, you know, what was his first military action in Africa? It happened before he even became president. I don't think people understand that.
Yeah.
They made a movie out of it. And people went to the movie theater watching this movie. I think it was called Captain something. Captain Tom Hanks played in a movie.
The one about the so-called Somali pirates.
I remember it like it was yesterday. He wins in November. He needs to be actually like, I don't know how you call it, inaugurated, I guess.
Inaugurated, yeah.
They inaugurate the president in January. So from November to January, this is the transition period, right? It wasn't George Bush.
Captain Phillips. Thank you. Yeah.
So it wasn't George Bush who made the decision to kill the Somali parrot. They had the National Security Council meeting with military advisors, with Barack Obama, the first black president, say, shoot these people, send the snipers and kill them. I don't have time for this. And they killed the so-called Somali parrot. No questions about why did they even stop the boat. They are dumping toxic waste. People can't fish anymore. Literally, these boats are coming and taking all the fish from the people, and people are being starved to death. And they say, you know what? You keep coming and taking our stuff, we'll start stopping your boat. And you got to pay up. This is called international toll on the ocean. You pay the toll, you go, because you've taken all of our fish. And the first black president killed. Nothing was, I don't think people even capture that that's his first one. And I'm sure you know what happened with, Gaddafi, right?
But even before that, he then goes to Ghana and gives that speech where he says, as when he's president, and says, Africa, stop complaining about colonialism. Your problem is corruption. And then he goes to Egypt and he tells the Arab Muslim population, don't get upset and use violence, because violence never helped anybody and certainly didn't help the United States get its freedom. So he gave this whole worldwide tour blaming Africans and North Africans or Arabs and Muslims for all the problems in the world that they face. So, Brother Kambale, I hope we didn't lose you through a freeze here. I think you've frozen. Happily, he's frozen in agreement with what I was saying. So I'll take that as a positive. And while we have this quick pause, please, folks, I would appreciate if we would do our guests the honor of turning our cameras on and being present. I think it's a little disrespectful to the extent possible that you don't have your cameras on. So please do turn them on if at all possible. There was something else he said I wanted to bring up. Anyway,
Can I ask a question?
Please. And anyone else, please raise questions.
When he comes back.
But feel free to start it now if you like.
And hopefully well, he just we'll left. So yeah. I'm going to wait until he comes back.
Okay. Do any of you have any reactions to what he said or questions about things he said so far? Oh, good. He's back. He's back. Go ahead and ask your question.
Okay. So in one of our assignments this week, I was kind of thinking about how Pan-Africanism started in the, it didn't start in Africa. So my question really is, how do you think Pan-Africanism, like what place do you think Pan-Africanism has in Africa? Do you think continental Africans want diasporic Africans to come back? Or like, what is, how do you think?
Yeah. So the way I base my Pan-Africanism is on the 5th Pan-African Congress. As you clearly pointed out, the Pan-Africanism has many different flavors of it. There are the Pan-Africanism of Garvey, there is Pan-Africanism of I don't know who, right? But the one that I based mine on and the organization that I'm also helping, working with, is the 5th Pan-African Congress. It's the most, in my view, Congress that took place. It happened in 1945, and it took place in Manchester, right at the end of World War II. I think it was around October, right? You had Dubois, you had Padmore, you had Kwame Nkrumah. Kwame Nkrumah and Padmore were the secretary of it. And you can study like who participated in it to understand the importance. They said, right, and that's why it's important to understand capitalism and why there is no other option but Pan-Africanism. They say that we can't talk about unity if you don't control the means of production. Simple as that. They say, what kind of unity are you talking about if you don't control your land, you don't control your resources? That's not Pan-Africanism. That's a club, you know, a club of friends coming together. So they say, in order for us to be united, we must control our land. We must control our resources. We must exploit the resources of the land for the benefit of African peoples. And when you look at the resolutions of it, they included the struggle in the United States of that time in the 40s. They included the Caribbeans, right? And they included the different struggles of anti-colonial struggle on African continent. And they gave a blueprint of how they're going to achieve the Pan-African unity. So when you see everything Kwame Nkrumah was implementing, is from that meeting. But then how concretely, let's talk about how did they implement. The people who participated in that meeting were his advisors. Padmore was working with Kwame Nkrumah in Ghana. Dubois was working with him there, right? So they all met in this conference. So think about how we all go to conferences, right? You share business card. What's your Instagram? What's your Twitter? Or you send an email. They were not about that. Let's just exchange contact. They're like, okay, you about it? Let's make it happen. So from 1945 to 1957, they had their eye on West Africa, and they made sure that Kwame Nkrumah became the head of state of Ghana, and he made Ghana now a liberated zone, right? So Ghana became like the focus. So since we have now liberated Ghana, let's liberate others. Che Guevara was in Ghana training people. I'm finding out now. Like, we had an event with the Cuban ambassador at the Pan-African Television about 2 weeks ago. I can share the link with you all to watch, where he was sharing that he was in Mali. He was in. This is not in books. This is what lived experience of people who knew that. So that's the Pan-Africanism I speak about, that we must take control of our land. We must take control of our resources. We must exploit these resources. And the profits of their resources should benefit all African people, be it on the continent or anywhere. Let's not forget West Papua, right? And let's not forget that we have black people in India. We have black people in Iran. Nobody want to talk about that, right? We are in many places around the world, but the African world is across the world. That's how I see it. Are there people who understand it from the perspective? Of course not. That's why I use the example of Ecobank. The African Union today, they actually believe they are a Pan-African organization. What are they doing about Nigeria right now? Nigerians are in the streets. Millions, right? They're being, just yesterday, they killed Nigerians by the police. Who's talking about that, you know? I mean, I'm sorry, there may be people who love Beyonce, but I think she needs to do more than just posting on a Beyonce.com page that she's in solidarity.
Beyonce and Jay-Z do a lot for African peoples. They do more behind the scenes. Like, from what I know, they're not really social media people, but there's been a lot of, like, I'll see if I can find an article about how much they actually donate and stuff like that.
Perfect. That's why I say I base my Pan-Africanism on the 5th Pan-African Congress, which called for a United States of Africa under the banner of socialism. It's a complete contradiction to me, no matter how much money Jay-Z gives to Africa or to anybody in the United States, what they did to the people of Brooklyn.
Ooh.
They gentrify. I mean, I lived in New York from 2010 to 2015. I remember when the community was mobilized. They said, don't put this stadium here. The story they told the people there. They told them that whenever everything is renovated here, you will be renting the space with subsidized rent. Many people did not want to leave their neighborhood, right? And they made us believe, the capitalist made us believe that that stadium belonged to him. So he gave cover to the capitalist. I don't know if you know the apartments that's across the...
Do you all understand the story he's talking about here? He's talking about the arrival of the Brooklyn Nets and the stadium, the Barclays Stadium. The Barclays insurance company.
Yeah. I mean, I, not only that, but Barclays, where did they make their money?
That's what I'm saying.
They're the slave traders.
That's what I'm saying.
Right? So they use this name. They made all of this, right? Those are the contradictions that we must understand.
But right? I'm sorry, Kambali. I just want to make sure, just so we're clear, because I am laughing and I get amped up when this stuff is brought up, but I am very serious about it. And I want to make sure you all understand what he's talking about. That before there was the Brooklyn Nets and the Barclays Stadium, Jay-Z was used to become a 1% owner of the team so that he could do what Brother Kambali is talking about by convincing black, mostly black, poor working class residents of Brooklyn to be welcoming of this stadium, thinking that they're going to have some sort of part in it, that Jay-Z's ownership makes them have a part in it. And what he was really doing was preparing and paving the way to get rid of them. So now that's why Brooklyn to this day looks very different. It has a very white upper middle class component to it that didn't previously exist, in part because of Jay-Z's leading the groundwork. So what I hear being discussed, that when he does that with Beyonce through philanthropy in the continent of Africa, he's just really easing the mechanism of capitalist control of European colonial dominance returning to the continent. Yeah. So I just want to make sure you all understand that part. But go ahead. Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah. But I'm saying it too. You should know they are African capitalists. Yes. It's not Jay-Z only, right? We have people who are very wealthy. Mo Ibrahim is a so-called self-made billionaire who made his money selling cell phones and setting up networks here. He has the Mo Ibrahim Foundation. They're the one also who funds in New York, the Museum of African Arts. No, he was going down. He put his money. The guy's filthy rich. But when you hear some of the policies that he pushes for Africa, you say, my God, this sounds like Bill Gates trying to do eugenics on Africans. Like, what are you talking about? We have too many people on the African continent. We are about a billion people on the African continent. India itself is 1.5 billion, right? I mean, and I can't go on and on, but I don't want
to... And just to be clear, if I'm not mistaken, Africa to this day, when all this talk about population control, Africa to this day still has the most space per capita in the world, right?
Exactly. So What we're talking about, think about a capitalist system. 400 years ago, right, a group of Europeans came on the African continent and met so-called chiefs. The bourgeoisie of Europe collaborated with the bourgeoisie of Africa. So we need to be very clear that there were Africans who worked with other powers to sell our brothers and sisters. But it's a class issue. It was the kings and queens, right? And sometimes I get agitated when people say about their African origin, I'm a king and a queen. And anybody will always tell me that this is what I say. If you're a king and a queen, I will fight you to death. Mm. Because I do not want to be your servant. With 1 billion people, not all of us are kings and queens. And not every king and every queen is a progressive leader. And many of them sold our people for salt, for mirror, for clothes, and salt. And that's what I said.
I'm sorry to interrupt, but I always say the same thing when people say that. I always say, man, I don't know exactly who my ancestors were, but I just feel it in my blood. They were working people. They were, they were not the king and the queen. My blood is working class to the core. So I feel the same. I appreciate you saying that. Only because I'm seeing that we're starting to head towards the last arc of the class. I want to make sure that folks here can raise some questions that I know that they have, and some that I would like to hear you address specific to the relationship between continental Africans and Black America. Because I know that's a lot of what we end up talking about in these classes and end up, seeing here. So, for instance, Tania is asking, do you think there will ever be a time where most of, if not all, countries in Africa will have control over their resources? Well, yeah, and thank you, Alex. Yeah, go ahead.
I mean, I believe so. Let's think of the history of Africa. I mean, Africa that we are seeing struggling here, we're talking about a 400-year struggle. Not, there was a time where Africa did not have this, right? No, we ruled out of the land. We had our own contradiction back then. That's not where we were. So life is a cycle, right? So now, because we are actually living this experience, it hurts. Say, wait a minute, what is going on? But when we understand the nature of the beast, we then say, if we know that the beast that's causing harm to us, that displacement of villagers in the Congo by so-called rebels, right, is similar to gentrification in Chicago, then we understand what is happening. Dispossession of land from people who are indigenous or the autochtones, as we say in French. Well, after a few years, guess what's going to happen? There will be a new demographic and so on. But it's happening in both extremes. So you look at Africa and say, hey, this is horrific. I mean, let's just look at now. I just mentioned Nigeria, right? Isn't that interesting that George Floyd, as his daughter said, will change the world, that right now in Nigeria, they're talking about end to police brutality right now. 200 million people are in Nigeria, right? The U.S. is 300 million, right? In Nigeria alone, they have 200 million people. Congo has 81 million. In the largest African country by population today, in the time of COVID, just as you have shown us the way, that COVID is not going to kill me, but you're not going to kill Elijah McClain. You're not going to kill George Floyd. You're not going to kill Breonna Taylor. Like the names, right? People on the African continent are also following the lead. So our struggles are the same. Then the question is, what are the tactics that we have to use to speed up that process? And for me, I'm basing it on the 5th Pan-African Congress. If you take control of your land and resources, I can exploit the resources there for the benefit, not of a small elite, the token ones, right? But the benefit of everyone, you will build roads, we'll build hospitals, and so on. And I'll go back to Chicago. Is there money in Chicago? Plenty of money. Plenty of money. It's actually also almost as a tax haven, Chicago and the state of Illinois, almost as Nevada for some corporations, right? But with that, right, why is Chicago experiencing highest rates of deaths of African Americans? Where is the wealth of Chicago going? So if you're already seeing it in Chicago and you say this is what's happening to us as Black people, you should be clear this is also what they're doing to us on the African continent. We don't control anything about us. We don't control our land. We don't control our resources. We don't control our government. Decisions are made against on our behalf without our consent. And that's why I spoke about the Berlin Conference. No African was in the meeting when I decided that this is French, this is British, this is Spain. You know, they control the Western Sahara region. This is Portugal. And then this one, we're not going to give it to a country. We're going to give it to a person. So determining our affairs is what's going to shift it. The tactics that we're going to use, as long as we understand, I'm talking a lot about capitalism, like seriously, like 20 years ago, I did not understand capitalism the way I understand it now. Like, I'm very humbled about it. Like, but when you get it, you get angry. Think about Amazon. That's the smallest example I can use. I've been sharing with people here. Jeff Bezos did not lift a box. He did not ship anything. He was confined like all of you. You want to tell me he's an entrepreneur with an idea? Idea doesn't make money. But that's what they teach us in school. Become an entrepreneur with a great idea. What makes money is the hundreds of thousands. They have 700,000 employees at Amazon. And many of them did not go to work because of COVID. They did not want to go there. They were laid off and so on. So you had a small number of employees working their butt off from March to now. And so-called investors who didn't even lift a box say, this is like $200. I'm going to bet that it's going to be $500. So whenever they're betting in the stock market, right, and say that this value is actually now the value of the company is higher, how does that translate? You work I worked at McDonald's too when I was in Greensboro. What do the managers say? Hey, we got message from upper management. We got to increase our profit. Last year we made 7%. Now we need to go to 15%. What does that actually translate to? You got to work more. I have no problem working more as long as that profit goes to me as the worker. Did any Amazon employee benefit from the high valuation of the company in the past 6 months?
No, they have to go on strike to get even some livable wages and some decent working conditions.
So we have now on the news, they're telling us.
Hold on, did you see that chat? Did you see the chat from Morris? They tell you that every day?
Yeah, I work at Amazon, and every day they tell us, like, we have a different goal to meet because, like the week before we were lacking, and, like, they would come around and tell us to work harder and, like, not do anything to help us at all.
So,
same
Morris.
Yes.
Oh, something for you too?
Mm-hmm. I work at UPS. They do the same thing.
So wouldn't you be happy if they ask you to do this, right? Work hard. But whenever we make profit, the money goes to your pocket.
Yeah, that would make a huge difference. Like, the only thing they do is, like, they offer, like, raffles that it seems like nobody wins.
And that's the point. One man has become the richest man. He didn't even lift a box. You did. He didn't do it. Like, he was confined, right? So that's I explain it in a very basic thing, because sometimes we throw this capitalism word and people are saying, oh, you're a socialist, you're a communist, you're a Marxist, or whatever that is. I'm like, let's just look at it at a very basic thing. And that's the essence also when I speak about Pan-Africanism. It makes no sense that African countries come together and they are using the same system of exploitation that they inherited for the colonial powers. And that is what is happening on the African continent. That we inherited a system of exploitation where Africa is looked at the place where the resources used for your cell phone, used for your laptops, your electronic device come from the African continent, the African people are massacred, killed, displaced, and they don't benefit from that. So if we mobilize to gain control, if the same way, if Amazon employees organize and mobilize to say, if we're going to work hard, the profit of this company should come to us. If UBS workers do the same, then you just start extrapolating it
to the African continent. So, but as somebody's asking earlier in the chat, what could, you know, sort of following up on the earlier point, what then could actually Jay-Z and Beyonce do? What would you like to actually see them do towards that end? Of or not just them, but anybody. What could people really be doing to push the agenda you're talking about? Celebrities and otherwise.
Yeah, I wish we had more Harry Belafonte. Mm. You know, Harry Belafonte was about it. He is still about it. Something I failed to mention in 2014, I was actually in Ferguson. The reason I went to Ferguson in August is when they killed Mike Brown. I saw myself in it. I saw the Congo. Like, he was just like, I got to go on the ground. I went on the ground. I was humble enough to be, I guess, protected by TEFPO, T-Dub. They had an organization called Hands Up United back then. They looked out for me even when we were on the front line. I remember one time I was on the front line. They kept coming to hit, right? And Tara Thompson, she was also part of the group. She literally came and tapped me and said, Kambale, they're coming for you. Come out. I was, how you know? I say, don't you notice that the more time they're coming to hit, they're coming where you are, right? They did that all the time while we were there. So I was humble enough to be there with them in Ferguson. And Harry Belafonte showed up. No camera, quiet, you know? Met the youth. Had radical session with the youth, like the type of things they were sharing in the room. I was like, is that Harry Belafonte I always hear about that sang Malaika and so on? Radical. And then I even started asking him, because people know about the support, financial support that he has given to people, to movements. And he was sharing, even I did not know that he has gone to the Congo. How many of you know that Harry Belafonte went to the Congo?
It's you all even know who Harry Belafonte is.
Yeah, I don't even know who that is.
The name sounds familiar, but I don't know who it is.
So, I hope I'm not getting too old.
The one thing that, let me just say this in the context of describing who he is. Harry Belafonte is one of the, he's a singer, dancer. He's famously for singing, you know, day-o, daylight, come at me, want to go home. But he and people like Paul Robeson and others and Canada Lee and Hazel Scott, they were all banned by the FBI and the Red Scare, and they were all blacklisted from performing and earning money. But the one point I want to make, Kambale, is that I think it's always important to point out that the reason we don't have more Harry Belafontes is because we just don't have currently the same organized movements, social movements, political movements here or abroad. Because just the names you mentioned, TEFPO, brother's name is T-Dub, yeah. Others. These would be the Harry Belafontes of this generation if the movement around them was organized, you know, because Belafonte had Dr. King and Malcolm X and those movements. Our movements aren't quite organized in the same way. So I think that, you know, and that's why we don't see. But to my class, that's, you know, Belafonte did a lot of the kind of work that you would want to see artists do with their fame and money to make room and fund activist work on the ground, even as it in many cases hurt, in some cases killed their careers. And in Paul Robeson's case, literally killed him. I mean, the CIA and MK Ultra and MI5 in England literally snatched him up and messed up his mind so he would be permanently removed from the struggle. But anyway, yes.
I mean, the point for me was for the stars, you know, there are ways you can engage. The engagement or support cannot be about, how can I say, humanitarian work. you know, that to me.
Well, I'm sorry to interrupt. Can I just say, look, for Jay-Z can't play the role of coming in to meet with, for instance, Roger Goodell and the NFL to say, we don't need to take knees anymore like Colin Kaepernick. We're moving on, to suggest that he wants a piece of ownership or black ownership, as if that's going to satisfy the point that Kaepernick was trying to make with his protest. That's the kind of thing that I think that artists like Jay-Z cannot continue to do. They need to follow the path of actual activists and not try to literally jump to the front of the movement and shift it to some right-wing conservative place. And again, forgive me that interruption. Sorry about that.
No, I mean, it goes to the same way. I mean, many of the engagements that I've seen of supports in Africa has been humanitarian work. Somebody will build some hospital, help people with malaria, and so on. And nobody asks, like, Africa is so rich. What kind of support do they really need? You know, Congo has 40% of Africa fresh water reserves, and people are dying from access to water. So it doesn't matter how many wells that I do, is what is the system that's causing that? So you start supporting liberation movements, right? Support those who are fighting to transform it. And many people are afraid to do that because, hey, you may lose a contract here. Look at what they did to Colin Kaepernick, right? That's a message that said, I mean, it's not as extreme as Patrice Lumumba, but the message is the same. They killed Patrice Lumumba, buried him, took his body out of the ground, put it in acid. What was the message they were sending to Congolese? If you dare become Patrice Lumumba, this is what we'll do to you. So for all the NFL players, superstars, when they see what happened to Kaepernick, you say, man, I got my child, I got my family, right? So whenever we come out of that fear and we actually join the movement with the people, then we'll see clearly, like, wait a minute. The U.S. ambassador in the Congo is moving around like a colonialist, like this is his home. I've gotten young Congolese already asking tough questions on the ground. He wonders where this question comes from. What are you doing about Black Lives Matter? The U.S. ambassador to the Congo is a white man. Not saying that a black person will not do the same. We've had black ambassadors too, right? But in the era of Black Lives Matter, we have this ambassador who's schooling us on democracy. Like, what are you doing there? We see how you tear gassing people and killing people. Are you coming to the Congo and do that? So that's one. The second one that I will hope these people are actually doing is connecting meaningfully with the African continent. It's not just about DNA. Yes, you can know where you are from, but like, we are linked. Everything that the United States and Europe benefit from comes from the African continent. Don't let them fool you. You will send $10 billion to support Africa in aid. You are taking $100 trillion out of the African continent. Congo's wealth is $24 trillion. That's the US and Europe GDP combined. So Africa has the wealth. So while you come with the charity, and then we thank you in the back, you have American corporations looting and exploiting. So the question is, as American citizens in the belly of the beast in Babylon, can we start naming names? Who are the corporations exploiting Africans? What are they doing on the African continent? Start telling people, I'm not going to invest in Tesla. I don't care how much Tesla is making, but they're getting cobalt from the Congo. I am not going to buy a Tesla vehicle. Right? And start doing that type of research. And the information is available. So it's how we meaningfully connect. Just as Dr. Ivan Sion connected with Congolese, and up until today, she's still connected. How do we do that now? Like, this here wouldn't happen before, right? I'm on African continent, you're there.
Go ahead, Alexia.
Do you think the erasure of like African history from Black Americans and Black, just the Black diasporics, is to blame for the disconnect from Africa? Like, you feel like us not really being able to dive into our origins and history as much because colonialism erased it is why there's such a disconnect?
And as you answer that, could you also add into your answer what impact this plays on relationships today between continental Africans and Black America or the diaspora? You know, in other words, when we hear the anti-Pan-African sentiments coming from both populations, what role does this education or lack thereof play?
Yeah. I mean, we've had many scientific evidence. I would have to agree with you, right? But we have to know that the miseducation is on both sides. I'm very lucky that I went to an HBCU where people took me to task, telling me the history of the uprising in at ANT. I don't know if you know about William Graham's. There was a standoff of ANT students with the National Guard. People don't even talk about it. Like, student had a standoff because they shot a student in the back of his head by the police in Greensboro. So I was very fortunate to meet people who taught me the African-American story. If I did not meet that, I would have been caught in the same circle where that is a fact, right? It's happening. There will be people who say, hey, don't hang out with African-Americans. You know, you may get shot. That's the stereotype. The same thing also on the African side, right? They'll be, these Africans are living with animals. They're savages, right? Now, look at it. They always have a war. They're always killing people. Why should we connect with people like that? That's not the Africa I want to know. So the miseducation is strong on both sides. But what helped, based on what the elders have shared with me, what helped in the 60s, particularly even with Malcolm, is he was actively engaged with Africans right in Harlem. You know, I don't know if you go to Harlem and you go to 116, you have all these Senegalese living there. This is Malcolm X's, like, vision. He was the one who connected the African and African-American community there. But it was intentional because he wasn't going to be taught in school. If he could say, who taught you to hate your hair back then, it's still true today. But he came out of that intentionally with people. So we have to create alternative ways of educating ourselves because we know that the education system that we are part of, they do not want us to know about this. What I'm sharing with you about Patrice Lumumba, I did not learn it in Congo. Patrice Lumumba is a hero. There is a national holiday in the Congo. But they don't talk about he was burned into acid when I'm in classes. Oh, we had a prime minister, he was assassinated. Finish. By who? They never told me in class that the CIA assassinated Patrice Lumumba. But I said it in this call, right? So miseducation is on both sides. The part that's worrying me right now, right, about both sides is class analysis. Because I think a month or so ago, I heard there is a new movement called ADOS.
Oh, my God.
Right?
So yeah, just very quickly. And then, unfortunately, we have to wrap up in about 15 minutes. So ADOS, do any of you students happen to know, have heard of this group? It's a new group that kind of popped up over the last couple of years online. I unfortunately have way too much experience with them and know too much about them, but they go by American Descendants of Slaves or Slavery. And their argument is that Black Americans need to cut themselves off from every other group and appeal to the United States government as a singular entity for reparations just for Black people. They don't want to be people of color. They don't want a connection to the Pan-African diaspora. And they, in fact, speak very negatively about Pan-Africanism and the diaspora and blame continental Africans for not supporting us as much as they take advantage of from the struggle of Black Americans and so on and so forth. It's a very un-Pan-African reactionary response to what we're talking about in this class. And that's as short and polite as about them as I can be.
Yeah. So when these things spurs, right, it's coming up. And then you look also in South Africa. Right now, there is a movement called South Africa First, which is terrible. It's like, how can you even say South Africa First when to end apartheid, it wasn't just South Africa.
They called the whole world.
Exactly, right? So you start seeing that there is there is something happening in our community because of the suffering that we are going through, of people infiltrating our movement and making it confusing. For people, I'm from the belief that if we are not united, I mean, I'll start quoting that. I'm sure I'm not the only one who say that. Pan-Africanism or barbarism. There is no other way. If you don't control your life, I mean, no shit to comrades, no, you work at UPS, you work at Amazon. You just explain how you don't control your work and they're exploiting you. And there's nothing you can do about it. Then I'm saying, no, there is something you can do about it. You can organize and make sure that what's yours is yours. And in you organizing, you will have to make alliances. Who else is exploited? That's the essence. Is as we start making the connections, like the same way I'm talking to you, that's how I talk on the continent with people. Because I had the blessing to spend some time, at least almost 2 decades in the U.S., in a black community, going to a black school and mobilizing. I said, guys, you don't know what's happening in the United States. So I'm sharing the experience about the your struggle that you share with me. You entrusted me with this knowledge, and I'm sharing it back. And it's the same thing that has to go, like it has to go both ways. Because the same people who are coming to sell your family with houses, with high interest, right? Know that, oh, you got a new house, and within 2-3 years, you see the interest go up, and you can't pay it. You know where they tested it? The IMF tested it on African countries. They literally gave loans to African countries, have indebted African countries, and we can't even pay the debt. So when I'm looking at this, I feel I call this the prime mortgage thing that caused the economic recession in the U.S. Mm-hmm. The IMF and World Bank had a scheme for the African continent that they called, what was this, something adjustment program. I have to think of the name again. It's skipping. But the program was, we give you a loan, you're going to repay. That's the surface. But they did not say the small notes, the terms of service that you can read, that the interest is going to go up and up, and it made many countries bankrupt. It tells you how to spend the money and others. But if we were linking and sharing information, I said, this happened on the African continent, this can happen to you, and we start building, whenever they're sending, like what you never question, American soldiers were killed in Niger. The news in the U.S. was talking about how Donald Trump did not speak well to the family. That's a crazy discussion to be had. Apparently called the mother or something and said something crazy. But nobody asked, why is a black man, American soldier, doing in Niger?
That's what I'm so glad you said that, man. When that story happened, that's what I kept asking. I was like, all you're saying is 4 soldiers got killed in Niger. Nobody's saying, why are there 4 soldiers in Niger? What is American soldiers doing there? What is this black man doing there? What are these other soldiers doing there in the first place? Anyway, thank you for that, man. It's just like, what is going on?
But then when we start sharing this information, we say, hey, we have drones. I mean, you probably don't see it yet. We have drones flying over our heads. Right now, you think of drone as DJI thing, doing a movie or something. Like, we have military drones flying all over West Africa. And sometimes they just fall out of the sky. Because there is a malfunction. Like, just think about something just in your neighborhood, just boom, it falls. And you wonder, what in the world is this, right? But the U.S. military presence on the African continent right now in 2020, it's like when they took African Americans to Vietnam.
Hey, we got to remember, we haven't talked about it yet in this class, but the Africa Command that the U.S. has instituted to basically control the militaries of all the African countries was initially run by or headed by General Kip Ward, who was a black general and graduate of Morgan State University. So, what? So, and it was at the time, it was proudly promoted, even within our university, that we have this General Ward is a black general. He comes from Morgan State. And I would quietly try to say, but he's leading the American militarization of the African continent. And that's not. And in fact, I will share at the time, there was a time I was asked to be part of a group of they wanted to the Defense Department was inviting communication scholars to help to get grant money to help put a positive spin on the Africa Command project. And I just asked some of my colleagues if we should even be doing this, much less talking about how it would be done. And then I was removed from the group. But in terms of talking about the anti-Pan-Africanist response to, you know, the anti-Pan-African use of the Pan-African diaspora, that's a wild contradiction there. Listen, we only have a couple minutes left, and because I do need to let my students go. A couple questions left in the chat. I'm going to ask, I don't know, I'm going to see if I can maybe follow up with you separately or have you answer them another time. Or I don't know, maybe you could do a quick, you know, summary statement that answers at least this question here from Ms. Tamaris about what do you think Black Americans can do to help Africa unite and move away from capitalism? Do you think that once Africa is united in control of their resources, they can push change in America? And maybe you could use that to develop your concluding statement for the night. And again, I thank you again for joining us, man. It's been great.
Definitely. I mean, this week is Congo week, so it's perfect that we're meeting today. Today is the fourth day of Congo week, Wednesday, where we actually ask people to think through more their connection with the Congo through technology. You know, the technology that we're using right now is really created and works due to Congo's minerals. So can we unite? Yes, we have, right? And when we even thinking about if our unity will push change in America, I don't even think about it that way. I think about it, Africans uniting, we are saving humanity. We are saving the world. So it's not America, because America is stolen land. Now, what do Native Americans feel about all these people who went out there, who have come to, I'm simplifying it, right? We came to gentrify their land. And they have no right to say about who becomes the leader of that land, who put a pipeline here, who put a pipeline there. They have no say whatsoever. So it's not just how change in America needs to be a human change. So African unity, because of who we are, like I'll use a small example. My tribe, I'm Nande. When you are born, they plant a tree. When somebody dies, they plant a tree. We are environmentalists by nature. That's in our culture that we plant trees. And my grandparents can go and say, this is your uncle, this is your grandparent, this is this. We tell our stories based on the trees that's been planted there, right? So our culture, our way of life, how we look out for each other, and I use myself as an example. People like you are the one who have taught me everything that I know that I'm doing now, right? And many of them are from the globe, but mostly people in Greensboro, North Carolina, they literally raised me to where I am. So our unity is the salvation of humanity. So let's not limit ourselves to America called the United States. Let's think that outside of Africa, the largest Black population is in Brazil. Most people don't know of Marielle Franco, who was just assassinated. The young Congolese are mobilizing for her, the killing that she experienced. So how do we unite for the liberation of humanity? Because if we don't, we're also going to suffer the destruction of this planet.
It's a sad note, but it's a perfect way to end. And I thank you very much for your work and for joining us. I'm very glad to have gotten to connect with you. And if everybody could quickly unmute and let's give him a round of applause and thank our guests for joining us. Thank you very much. I'll be in touch again. I hope to connect with you again soon and wish you the best in that of your comrades on your travels and work. And thanks to all of my students for hanging in there tonight. I will be in touch via Canvas and see you all next week. And let's end it the way Fred Hampton used to say. I say peace to you if you're willing to fight for it. So peace, everybody. And I'll catch you in the whirlwind like Garvey. All right. Thanks again, Brother Kambali. Thank you very much, man.
Thank you. Thank you, everyone.
Take care.
Peace.